From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, writer Malcolm Gladwell talks about the trouble with high rates of black male incarceration. Plus, a foundation seeks to keep the children of inmates in school and help them go on to college.
Out of those dropouts, 60% end up in jail. It's certainly cheaper to try to get these kids in school than it is to incarcerate them.
We'll learn about the Milwaukee area's very own School of Rock. And supporters of urban farming hold up a Milwaukee pocket park as an example of what can be done.
And over 2 years, with working and different neighbors participating and lots of meetings, lo and behold, we have this park.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Over the last several months, WUWM has been investigating the high rate of incarceration of black men in Wisconsin and Milwaukee. We've heard from community leaders who say putting so many men behind bars is hurting our communities, whereas Milwaukee's police chief argues communities must be protected from those who commit crimes. Author Malcolm Gladwell is inclined to agree with the former argument that the impact on our neighborhoods outweighs the benefit in fighting crime. It's part of a broader argument about how we misunderstand power and misidentify advantages and disadvantages, an argument in his new book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Gladwell tells Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce his theory applies to how we fight crime in our communities.
Well, the same thing I think happened in the 90s when this country went through that wave of dramatically increasing the penalties for crime. I think there's very compelling evidence that if you make penalties a little bit harsher, you can bring down crime. If you make them too harsh, you start to make the problem worse. And this is a really provocative line of reasoning that many criminologists have begun to argue. And they point out that, you know, if you lock up too many people, what you do is you destroy the communities where they come from. So every time you lock up someone, you have a direct effect on crime, which is you have removed that criminal from the population. But you also have an indirect effect, and that is that you have removed someone from a community where he might be a father, a breadwinner. You've taken away someone's father. And one of the things we know about kids, when one of their parents goes to jail, that's just about the most devastating thing that can happen to you. Your rates of juvenile delinquency go soar, your rates of mental illness go up, your rates of dropping out of school go way up. You know, each person you lock up, you also have an effect on the community. And the argument is if you lock up too many people, the community effects become greater than the individual effect of locking up a criminal. In that in this country, in many states, we made penalties so harsh they were doing more harm than good. California being the perfect example. I mean, California pushed criminal penalties further than any other, not just any other state in the union, any other state in the world. California had some of the toughest criminal penalties to be found in the world after the three strikes rule was passed there in the 1990s. And there's a very compelling argument to be made that they ended up having a crime problem that was worse than it would otherwise have been if they had done nothing at all. There's a case where what you think you're doing is giving yourself an advantage in the fight against crime, and you're not. The money you're spending locking people up is making the problem worse.
Why isn't that method effective in deterring would-be criminals facing possibly a very long sentence for committing a crime? Why doesn't that potential looming sentence deter them from committing more crimes?
Well, it does in some cases, but the argument is that the effect on the communities they've left is greater. The negative effect is greater than the positive effect on the criminal. But in large part, it doesn't. And there's been a lot of very careful examination of this question in the psychological and criminology literature. And the reason is that it deters you and me. So if the penalty for speeding was jacked up to $1,000 for every mile you sped over the speed limit, and if you were caught doing more than 10 miles over the speed limit, you went to jail. If that was the penalty, you and I would no longer speed, ever, right? we would look at that, we would say it's just not worth it. But we aren't typical criminals. The typical criminal is a 17-year-old adolescent who is high on drugs or drunk and who has limited life prospects and limited education and is living in desperate circumstances. That kind of person does not respond to rational incentives the same way that the rest of us do. So that's the problem, that we make an assumption about the way criminals are supposed to behave based on the way we think we would behave. But we're not typical. One of the astounding facts about crime is that crime is a phenomenon that is an enormous percentage of serious crimes are committed by boys and men between their sort of late teens and early 20s. It's a young man's business. And I, you know, as someone, I remember what it was like to be a young man. When you're an 18-year-old boy, you're not normal. I was pretty normal, but even then I wasn't that normal. We're dealing with a very different kind of psychology when we're dealing with a typical criminal. They don't necessarily respond to incentives the way the rest of us do.
So in a place like Milwaukee County, where more than half of African-American men in their 30s have served time in prison, are we being effective at all in fighting the crime?
No, I would say that the damage, if you go into a community, a neighborhood, and you lock up half the young men, you do such extraordinary damage to the fabric of the community that I cannot imagine that you're doing more good than harm. You have to weigh the community effect, the damage to the community, against the good that comes from locking up someone who is violent or dangerous. And it's a delicate balancing act. And there isn't an easy way to figure out what that balancing act is, but I think what that balance is. But I think that there are a number of places in this country where we went too far where the balance got out of whack. We went too far in one direction, and we've got half the young men locked up. That's at some point in their lives, that's too much.
So what would be a more effective way of deterring crime while limiting the impact in our communities?
Well, I think there are any number of ways, but one of the things that we have learned in New York City, so New York City has become the most extraordinary crime-fighting, crime-reduction case study in the history of the West. I mean, it's what's happened in New York in the last 10 years is really amazing. So New York participates in the same crime reduction during the 90s as everyone else, but then when the rest of the country flattens out, New York, crime in New York continues to fall. So what do we learn from New York? Well, one of the things we learned from New York is that this second historic crime drop in New York that we've seen over the last 10 years has happened as the prison population in New York City has fallen. So we have been locking up fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer people, and the crime rate has dropped. So lesson number one is, if you want to keep that momentum of crime reduction continuing, it is not the case you need to lock up more people. New York has proven the opposite, that by throttling back on locking up people, you can restore the health of communities. And remember, it is communities are the places that actually restrain crime. They play it's families and communities and peer pressure and all those elements that are the most important elements in crime reduction. The second thing we've learned from New York is that if policing gets smarter, you'd have a much better effect in preventing crime through effective policing than you can by locking up criminals after the crime has been committed. So the city has just gotten a lot smarter in how to deploy police effectively and to create a police presence that means that the person who would have committed a crime never commits it in the first place. So the cycle is broken. And the third thing is getting guns off the street, you know, that so much good comes from really, really aggressive means of measures in getting removing guns from the street. So many fights that would have ended up in tragedy end up in a bloody nose when there's no handgun coming into play.
Best-selling author Malcolm Gladwell has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1996, and prior to that, a reporter at The Washington Post. His latest book is called David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. He's previously the author of books including Blink and Outliers. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce. One of the many angles to the story of black male incarceration in Milwaukee and elsewhere is the impact it has on the families of those in prison. In the U.S., some 2 million children are believed to have one or both parents behind bars. But a program in place in Milwaukee and a handful of other locations aims to have prisoners play a role in their children's future educational success. Percy Pitzer is a former prison warden from Texas and heads the Creative Corrections Education Foundation, which raises money for college scholarships benefiting the children of current and former inmates. And inmates are contributing to the fund. Pitzer joins us on the line from Texas. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let me ask a really simple question to start with. Why you? Why is this your project?
Well, you know, I worked in prisons for nearly 30 years, and I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of kids go through the visiting room, and you could almost pick out who your next client was going to be. And I thought if I ever had the opportunity that I was going to try to do something to try to prevent that.
When did the light bulb go off for you that this could be a tool, this idea of helping some of these kids make it into higher education? When did that finally set in for you?
I've actually been looking at it for several years, but in the last couple of years I got more serious about it because I was in a better position to do it, actually financially, because my wife and I have put quite a bit of money in to get it started.
Did it ever strike you for the length of time that you were working in the prison system that you actually were considering the lives of the people outside the prison walls as much as you were considering, you know, as you were managing the lives of the people that are inside the prison walls?
Oh, I think I've always considered that. You know, families, when a person is incarcerated, a family does just as hard, if not harder time than a person that's incarcerated.
Well, and connect the dots for us. You know, what do you see scholarships and higher education for the children of inmates themselves and former inmates? What do you see them having to do with the broader issue of incarceration? Why does it strike you that you're so likely to see your next clients in the people that are visiting the family member in prison?
Well, you know, for an example, in the Milwaukee area, you know, I read some statistics that only 47% of the African-American young men graduate from high school. And out of those dropouts, 60% end up in jail. It's certainly cheaper to try to get these kids in school than it is to incarcerate them.
Do you feel, you know, when you're considering the children of inmates and ex-inmates, does it mean to some degree that you're conceding that something has been lost, some opportunity has been lost for the inmates themselves? I mean, this is not necessarily about improving their own odds after they get out of prison.
Well, you have to look at what we're doing as a nation. When I started in the prison system, America had approximately 200,000 people incarcerated. Today we have 2.3 million incarcerated. When I started working in the Bureau of Prisons, we had under 23,000 inmates incarcerated in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Today we got in excess of 219,000. I mean, at some point we have to say, what are we doing? You know, we have a prison industry budget of around $65 billion a year. We have to take a look at that and see if we are, in fact, doing the right thing. And if we took a serious look at it, we could probably find better ways of doing things.
What originally brought you to the Bureau of Prisons? Why was that the work that you chose to do?
Well, I had just got out of the military after serving 5.5 years, and it was available, and I went to work there. Actually, when I went to work, I knew very little about the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
Your initial goal wasn't to be a warden.
No, I don't think I could have ever visualized that at that time.
Did you see an ability to affect change in that role? I mean, even as the reality of prison life in America was changing, were you in a position where you could make something happen and, you know, work towards an end?
Probably not. I mean, when you're working in a prison, I mean, you operate programs and you try to improve the situation of individuals, but you also try to maintain a safe and secure environment for the inmates and the staff working there.
Why is it important to you that the people in prison play a role in supporting the scholarship fund?
Well, you know, contrary to popular belief, the overwhelming majority of inmates, even though they're incarcerated, still care about the children out there in the community. I don't think our society understands that. I've done many fundraisers with inmates over the years, and they get involved, and they do care about the community for the most part.
Well, and I know you've been to for example, the Milwaukee County House of Corrections, and what do you hear from inmates when you go into a place like that and make your case for what you're trying to do?
Well, I mean, they're, for the most part, very positive, and they get involved. Of course, some can't. I mean, we're not asking for much. We're asking that you consider donating the price of a candy bar a month. You know, considering we have 2.3 million people incarcerated, if we got 10% of them participating in this program, I mean, we could send hundreds of thousands of their children to school versus prison. You know, it's that old saying, it's cheaper to send a kid to Yale than it is to jail.
Well, and, you know, you're talking about the price of a candy bar a month, which, yeah, seems like, you know, a drop in the bucket to many of us. But as you say, you know, these are not people that are making a lot of money. Is there something symbolic about it as well? The idea that, you know, these inmates are actually trying to play a role in bettering life for the people on the other side of the walls?
Well, I don't know if it's symbolic or not. I think it's just, I guess my goal is to try to show society that even though these individuals are incarcerated, because they're incarcerated doesn't mean they still don't care about the children in the community.
The most recent data available, I think, shows there are 1.7 million children in this country with a parent behind bars. How much difference do you think you and this foundation can make?
Well, if we keep one kid from going to prison, I think it's a big difference. And I think we'll actually do better than that.
Did you ever, in your time as a warden and in creating this program, think to yourself that, you know, these people in prison, they made choices that got themselves in this position. Why should it be up to me to make things better for their kids?
Who is going to do that? Who knows both sides of the coin? Who has the ability to at least attempt to make that change in their life? You know, I am the system. I've worked in it for 30 years. I am in the community. I see what's going on out here. And I think that there could be a partnership. We have to do something because of the, you know, that number of incarceration keeps increasing, and so does the kids out there without a parent. And, I mean, we have to look at that. Or the incarceration rate is going to go much higher than it even is.
Are you already seeing effects from this? I guess what I don't know is how far along the foundation is in its work and whether people are already taking advantage of the money that's been raised.
We've only been going about 18 months, and we've given 41 $1,000 scholarships. We anticipate this year we'll probably give 100 scholarships because things are going much better. Right now we have the state of Texas, state of Ohio, state of New Mexico, and the Milwaukee House of Corrections on board with us. And we see that growing with other states in the country.
Well, and how are you connecting with the people that are receiving the scholarships? And you know, given that there are so many people behind bars with so many children on the outside, you know, how are you making the determination of who's most worthy of these scholarships?
Well, they apply. They can apply online at creativecorrectionseducationfoundation.org. And they have to apply through the website, or they can call us and we can help them apply. They have to apply for a Pell Grant. That shows that they have a need for it if they get approved for the Pell Grant. They have to have a parent incarcerated or a parent on supervision within the community. They have to write an essay explaining to us why they think we should give them a scholarship. And we try not to deny anybody. And believe me, when you read some of these essays these kids give us, it literally brings tears to your eyes, some of the things that they've been through. And, you know, it's the right thing to do.
Well, Percy Pitzer, it sounds like a really remarkable thing to do as well. And I thank you so much for sharing it with us, and best of luck in your work.
Well, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Percy Pitzer is co-founder and president of the Creative Corrections Education Foundation, which raises money and awards scholarships to the children of current and former prison inmates. Pitzer is a retired prison warden who lives in Beaumont, Texas. Milwaukee is one of the locations the foundation serves. What's the big deal about headaches? Actually, from a public health standpoint, they are a pretty big deal. We'll learn why when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. I have such a headache. We say the words almost without thinking anything is out of the ordinary. Headaches for many people are, if not an everyday, certainly a common occurrence. But what is a headache more than a minor nuisance? The answer is probably more than we might imagine. Dr. Fred Freitag is an associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Froedtert Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Thanks for being here.
Thanks very much, Mitch. Glad to be here.
So let's start with some perspective. I think if most of us looked at a list of health concerns, we might be tempted to place headaches below the feared diseases, you know, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, things like that. How big a deal are headaches from a societal standpoint?
Well, it's the seventh most common presenting problem in primary care. Migraine headache, which is the most common of the headaches, affects roughly 30 million people in the United States. And the World Health Organization ranks attacks of migraine among the top 10 disabling conditions worldwide. Billions of dollars are spent just on direct health care, let alone time lost, decreased productivity.
You say direct health care. That's things like going out and buying medicine or
– going medicines, doctor's visits, prescriptions, hospitalizations, emergency room visits.
Well, and considering how frequent an issue migraines and presumably other forms of headaches are, why do they not get the respect that other diseases do?
Part of the problem is that headache is no one's baby, all right? You have neurologic problems that cause it, ear, nose, and throat problems that cause it, gynecologic problems, it affects kids, affects adults. So it never got taken up as an area of concentration of study by a concerted group of physicians. And so everybody kind of just kind of blew it off, if you would, all right? Well, in the last 20 years now, we have organizations that are devoting their efforts to it. We have certification going on. And with it, we're getting much better quality of care being delivered to headache patients.
Well, and given that headaches can come as a result of a variety of causes, is it difficult? I mean, is that one of the pressing issues in the field is getting all the various specialists, the neurologists, the ENTs, the other people on the same page about what's going on?
Oh, it certainly is. You know, and the doctors who practice pain medicine. So the organizations really are now kind of blended. They have specialties and talks are given in across the areas. So you really have to kind of know a little bit of everything in order to really do good work in headache. And really that's the focus of our training programs nowadays.
The word headache itself, I mean, sometimes just feels like a generic term. You know, people think nothing of saying, yeah, my head really hurts today. At what point – I mean, is there a threshold for when a headache is more than, you know, I'll put it in air quotes here, just a headache?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are certainly serious causes for headache and, you know, warning signals such as pain medicine is not working, being there every day, having other symptoms besides the headache pain are all kind of flags that says, wait a second here, I'm not your garden variety headache, okay? You need to see somebody.
Migraines, of course, get a lot of press. Are they the only form of headache that rises to the level of needing treatment by a neurologist or another specialist?
No, they're not. But if we were to do a survey in a family practice office, two out of every three people sitting there have migraine. They may not be seeing the doctor for migraine, but they have it. So it is just so common and has so much impact. That's the one that ends up being the most common thing that people end up being treated for. But people sometimes want to avoid calling it that because it has a bad connotation. But you know, it really is very common. You know, I mean, everybody from Thomas Jefferson to, you know, basketball, football players, you know, have migraine. Doesn't spare anybody.
How do we know Thomas Jefferson had migraine? I wouldn't imagine that migraines were there was not a clinical definition in those days, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, but he wrote about them in his journals. And we also have his orders for willow bark, which they made into a tea, which contained basically aspirin. He bought a phenomenal amount.
Well, I feel like we should talk a little bit more about migraines because, as you say, there are probably a lot of people that have them and don't even necessarily think that they have them or realize it. What's going on in the head of someone with a migraine?
The nervous system is overfiring. People with migraine have a hyperreactive nervous system. When it overfires, then the blood vessels start to dilate, pain messages get generated. Then other parts of the body's nervous system get recruited, so you get neurological symptoms and your stomach goes sour on you and nothing tastes good and comes back up. And that really is the whole constellation of symptoms. And most people with migraine can't function normally during their attack. They have to curtail their activities. Doesn't mean they're in bed, but you know they get through the workday, pour themselves onto the couch and they sleep it off until the next day when they wake up, and sleep relieves the attack many times.
Is there any one single root cause for this, or is this one of these cases where environment and other factors are playing into it?
First of all, you have to have the right genes, okay? And migraine probably is a genetic disorder. But then there are a variety of outside factors we call trigger factors that cause people to get their attacks. Weather change, changes in the amount of caffeine they consume, certain foods, stress, hormonal changes for women, all are common things that set headaches in motion, migraine in motion.
You said stress and you know, there's this, I think in the general sense, people talk about the idea of a tension headache.
Right.
Is a tension headache just a subset of a migraine?
It's on the borderline end of it. When they get to be chronic, they actually have migraine characteristics to them and respond to the same kind of medications. There are people who get pure stress headaches that are tension headaches. Then there are those people who get tension-type headaches because they've had very frequent migraines, and they just kind of spill over and become a headache all the time, and that's a lot of what we see.
There's another kind of headache out there that has gotten some attention called a cluster headache.
Yes.
What is that we're talking about?
Well, it's a different kind of headache that comes from the blood vessels, and it's a short headache. It only lasts from a 15 minutes to maybe an hour or so, but it's extremely intense. Instead of getting sick and having light bother you when you have migraine headache, their eye waters and runs and gets red, their nose runs, they pace. The pain is so severe that it's been nicknamed the suicide headache. And men are a little more prone to getting it than women, just the opposite from migraine.
What do we know about what's causing those?
That we don't know very much about. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot because it's relatively rare. It's 1% of the population. But also the attacks are so severe that cluster patients won't readily volunteer to be guinea pigs, if you would, in studies so we could find out what's going on. Many years ago, we tried to get a patient to have an attack of cluster headache on film, okay? No. He fired us as his doctor for even suggesting the idea.
Nobody wants to take one for the team.
No, they don't.
Is there something about the way our culture operates that makes people any more prone to headaches than they were in times past? I mean, you said Thomas Jefferson had migraines, but we do spend a lot of time, you know, staring at the environmental factors you were talking about sound like they might be more common today.
They probably are more common. It's also – but the other thing is it's more commonly talked about, okay? You know, back even 70 years ago, you know, it was just a problem you had, okay? And you live with it because there was no treatments for it and they didn't know what it was. Nowadays, as we know more, we talk about it more, we're more sensitive to it. So I think it's more just familiarity rather than actually life being that much worse.
How much more optimistic is the outlook for people who are dealing with either migraines or cluster headaches in terms of the kinds of treatments that are available versus just a few years ago?
Oh, we've made such strides in the last 20 years on treatments that are available and recognition that if we can do medications or lifestyle changes to reduce one's tendency to get the headaches, then we can truly alter the long-term course of their illness. You don't have to have migraine through your entire life. If you get good help when you're a young person with the headaches, that may be it. You may never have them again. So we've come to learn that and be able to offer that to people. And we're always developing new things. We're going to be looking at giving an antibody to people for a chemical that's triggering the migraines. And the early studies look very, very positive. So there's some very fascinating things out there.
Come a long way since willow bark.
Oh, my, haven't we?
Dr. Fred Freitag, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure, Mitch. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Fred Freitag is an associate professor in the Department of Neurology at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. We spoke with him in November. We'll take a break now, and when we return, we'll learn about the Milwaukee area's very own School of Rock and its approach to teaching music. This is Lake Effect from WUWN. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. For many of us, learning music as a child was a chore, sometimes fun and often not. Practicing scales on a clarinet or chords on a piano might seem for many kids far removed from what they really want out of music, just to play the songs they like. While some really are interested in playing in an orchestra, others would rather be in a rock band. Enter the School of Rock, the Milwaukee area location of a national business opened not long ago with the aim of combining learning with the art and excitement of performing it. This Sunday, on the 50th anniversary of the Beatles' first Ed Sullivan performance, students at the School of Rock will play a British Invasion show at the Miramar Theater. Todd Richards is general manager of the School of Rock. Micah Olson is a guitar instructor there. Richards tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon how the worldwide business evolved.
It was something that started out of, you know, very grassroots out of someone's house, and it just kept expanding. And eventually, you know, somebody wanted to invest in it, and it became an international franchise.
Was this in reaction to the boring way of learning to play music, or is this something revolutionary involved in this whole concept?
Well, I think in a way, yes, because it's not that inspiring, I think, for young kids necessarily, you know, to start sort of like a conservatory method or kind of limited to only jazz or classical, which is what most people sort of start you off with, unless you're doing like the individual, you know, guy in the neighborhood who will teach me some rock licks. So I think it was sort of the idea of getting people together. You learn more from the group experience, but then you have that combined with an individual lesson, you know, for like a sort of like the deeper theoretical understanding of what you're doing. You know, so for example, if I'm learning Back in Black, you know, I'm working on it in the group. It's simple parts. You know, we're learning how to play together in time. It's inspiring to look over and see your buddy playing with you. But then in my lesson, that's when, you know, someone like Mike might say, like, okay, well, let's take a look at those licks you're playing. Okay, that comes from, you know, the pentatonic scale. You know, so you're getting both sides of it. They're really like reinforcing, you know, the application with the knowledge.
And Micah Olson, you just mentioned Micah Olson is here. Maybe tell us your take on the instruction. You know, me being one of those people that did take piano lessons for a while. So I'm wondering, wow, what if this had been around when I was taking piano lessons? What would be different?
Do you still play piano? That might be different.
on occasion.
Okay. No, I think the approach of having it be an activity that you can do with your friends and, you know, being in a group just makes a big difference. For me, at least, practicing, and I didn't mind it. I started practicing acoustic guitar and writing songs, so I didn't really mind doing that by myself, but say if you want to play lead guitar, you're kind of in – if before there was a school that would do kind of group classes like that, you're just, you know, maybe playing by yourself, shredding away, listening to albums. There's nothing wrong with that. But if you can go in and put that in a band, or be in a group that, you know, with a drummer and a bass player and the actual lineup of the song, it becomes much more real, and it's less like practice, and it's more of a game.
Does it make reading notes or learning to read notes a little more mundane, harder to deal with, or do you think it maybe has the opposite effect where it provides the motivation to learn to read
notes? I think it provides the motivation, because if you keep the inspiration level up, you know, I mean, that's where most students, I think, you know, when they start looking at just written stuff that, you know, I go home and I practice this, I come back, I kind of regurgitate it, you know, or like, sure, you know, you're learning dynamics and things like that. It's not the same as, wow, you know, I'm so inspired by this, you know, I want to go deeper into this, you know, and there's, you know, and I'm not putting down any, you know, sort of genre of music, classical, jazz. I mean, they all use the same information. But the thing about starting where someone's inspired, you know, that's them now pursuing it versus, you know, like that scenario of the parents saying, well, you have to do, you know, 4 years of piano. And then after that, we'll think about the guitar that you actually want. You know, so we're starting with like what the actual student wants to pursue. And then from there, they're on their own. You know, they're on their own in terms of it's their inspiration that's sort of the engine versus, you know, like, well, we're paying for this, so you better... You know, you better practice, and you've got a lot of note reading. I mean, after a point, that does some students, it is a turnoff. It wears them down. We definitely teach, you know, all the theory and the note reading as well.
Well, however, some students do take one-on-one lessons outside of School of Rock, and then they might be in a performance class and have a private lesson there.
Yeah,
you know,
it's
the number
not,
of the yeah. families, like Shorewood has a really supportive musical community, and so there's a lot of families that really push music. And so they might be doing kind of both sides.
And performance is the goal here, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So in your upcoming show, which is the British Invasion, is that what it's called, right? Are all students going to be performing at whatever level they're at in this show?
Well, it's the students that are in the performance group. We have two essentially classes that have performance based right now. One is Rock 101, which is for like starting out 8-9-year-olds. Some of them like have just started playing. Most of them like, have had a lesson or two. That group, their focus isn't performing. That's just getting them, you know, some basic knowledge in about the instrument, get them into a group playing some simple songs that they can make it through, and then hopefully push them on to the next level. The performance class is the one that puts on the shows, and that's a 3-hour rehearsal once a week that they do. So everyone that is involved in the performance group will be a part of the show. And depending on their ability and how many songs that they can take on, that kind of makes how big of a part they have in the show.
Okay. Yeah, we actually cast students into songs, you know, based on like where they are developmentally, what might be a challenge for them, might be like sort of a strong suit, you know, and we pair them up with other people. You know, there might be a drummer like who's kind of precocious, like he's got it. Well, then we're going to put him with somebody who maybe needs some work on the rhythmic plane, you know, because a better player always takes you up to their level, you know. So somebody who's like, oh, they're working hard. This is going to help, you know, kind of push them to getting that confidence on their instrument.
I'm sorry to keep bringing this back to note reading because maybe I just have a hang up as far as reading notes. I don't know. But because I'm one of those people that learns to play music without notes. So
sure.
I'm not a good note reader, but I can just pick it up and through, you know, trial and error, I usually learn a song that way. So
your training's really important. Nick Berg, one of our, I think he teaches Rock 101, and he'll be doing some of the recording stuff for us. But he is definitely somebody who, I mean, you know, I can put a chart in front of him and say, hey, can you play this for me? But ultimately, I think he's got a huge focus on getting their ear to understand what it is they're hearing on the instrument, being able to find it, you know, hear the relationship and then find it on the instrument. So it's as much as there is, you know, the, I guess, more common method or accepted method of note reading, there is focus on ear training as well.
All right, because anyone that has seen a band, just gone to any Cactus Club or wherever in the city, they don't use
They're
notes.
Not having, they don't
no one looks at notes.
Yeah, most of the time they don't.
And is that something that you're open to? Students that aren't really geared that way, they have a place in.
Yeah, I mean, everybody learns a little bit differently. I mean, ultimately, I think you want to have sort of equilibrium with all those different elements. I mean, you should be able to do some reading. I'm not, you know, you don't have to be able to read, you know, Rachmaninoff at 220, you know, to be good as a musician or an artist. But I mean, you should be able to get your way through something. You know, you should have at least the fundamental. I can see a chart and I can read my way through it. And I should also, on the flip side, be able to hear something and find it on the instrument.
There's some things, especially on like guitar, note reading might make what is could be a very simple part to play look and be incredibly complex. Take like Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, which is like when you start learning power chords, that's a song that I think, or at least when I was, everybody played. It's fairly simple. You get to do the muting in there. But if you look at that rhythm written out and you look at it in notation, I would spend like weeks like, okay, one and – oh, no. Okay, okay.
It looks like hieroglyphics.
So you start – you know, things like that, your ear and kind of your understanding of the rhythm I think is equally if not more important than understanding the written notes. So you kind of use both of them to give the student as clear of a perspective of what's going on.
So we've been focusing mainly on kids, you know. How many people come there are over 18 or even, dare I say, over 40 perhaps?
Sure.
Is it ever too late to learn?
I think we had somebody who was just about 70.
Yeah, I'm not going to say her age because I don't want to get it wrong.
In general, I would say, you know, anywhere from maybe 20 to 40 would be the ages roughly of the adults so far. Some are in individual lessons. I mean, and that's usually because of more of a time constraint. You know, I mean, we are a high commitment, you know, as far as like the 3 hours plus a 45-minute individual lesson. So for, you know, some adults just with work schedules, like, hey, I really want to get going with this. So they might just take an individual. But then we do have an adult performance group that's on Sundays from 12 to 3. And right now I know they're working on Badge by Cream. I think the Stooges are in there. You know, they're doing all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, the adult program, they can do more of, I think, where it's open to the songs that they pick. They're not like with the kids program, we have a theme for every show. So if it's like for my show, the British Invasion, I couldn't go and pick Adele or, you know, just wouldn't. I mean, it's British, but it's not at the right time period. But the adult classes, it seems to be.
It's a little freer because they are adults. But eventually for their show, I mean, we'll probably weed it down to, you know, something that has a common thread to it. But they sound great. You know, I mean, we've got a firefighter on drums, a couple students at MATC on bass and guitar, and then a singer who, you know, is a professional, an adult professional who was just like, you know, I love singing. I had some experience about 5-6 years ago, and I just want to keep pursuing that. And they sound great. I mean, I was impressed.
Is there anything different about the adult mind or the adult way of learning music? I mean, I think there's some adults have even more of a fear of going back and learning music than when they were kids.
Yeah, and especially if they come in for like a trial or a tour, you know, you sense some of the apprehension of like, well, you know, maybe I'm crazy to think I should do this. But I actually think it's really – I mean, I actually get hope out of that.
I think it's cool.
Yeah, the idea of like, you know, making the time for something that's going to – you get to express yourself – you know, just taking the time to have that be a place in your life as an adult versus sort of like, no, I can't do that. I'll just let the guitar accumulate, you know, dust and I'll sort of fondly remember my college years or whatever. But to actually like go out there, meet new people, you know, who have that same interest, you know, just as if, I guess, you know, if you're into sailing, you join some kind of club for that.
Well, so do you approach adults differently as far as the methodology?
When I'm teaching an adult student, I don't enjoy it necessarily more, but they have built up a reason why they're there. Whereas a lot of younger students, when you go, well, what music do you really like? They might not have formed that opinion yet. And that's kind of – that's the exciting thing there. You get to help them with that. But adults are like – they generally have a reason why they picked it up and something that really pushes them to get through that. So you can talk to them on a little deeper level, and I think I can – you know, I don't know. There's just a deeper understanding, I guess. You can go into the theory a little bit more without being like, okay, you're sleeping now.
All right. Tell us a little more about the show that's coming up. And this is, of course, open to the public, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, encouraged, I'm sure.
Yeah, you can get tickets for it at the school, or you can buy them the day of at the Miramar Theater over on Oakland, which is, I mean, just a wonderful venue in Milwaukee. And we have two shows. One's at 2:30 and the other is at 5. And the focus is the Brit invasion, which is nice for us because it really includes so many fundamental things in it. Musically, it's got, you know, it's got harmonies, it's got rhythms, it's got arrangements. But yet it's still the sum of the parts is much bigger than the parts themselves. You know, so it's not too daunting for anybody. But at the same time, we've got a keyboardist who's playing all the – is it Rob Argent from the Zombies? He's playing
He's playing the Zombies riffs.
All those keyboard parts. He's doing it, you know.
All right. Sounds like fun. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks,
Dan. Thank you.
Todd Richards is general manager of the Shorewood branch of the School of Rock. Micah Olson is a guitar instructor there. School of Rock students will play two British invasion-themed shows Sunday afternoon at the Miramar Theater. They spoke with Dan Harmon. One last break, and advocates for urban farming hope one local success story spurs more interest in the field. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Despite the cold and snow that stubbornly refuses to go away, people interested in farming, urban farming, will gather tomorrow to sign up for garden and hydrant permits. People can also dig into workshops on rainwater harvesting and setting up compost systems. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz brings us the story of an evolving neighborhood garden. It started, as do many others, with a troublesome vacant lot, this one on Madison in the Silver City neighborhood, and a new resident. Meet teacher Brett Lipschutz.
I live in the greenhouse just right over there, so on Madison Street. This is the garden. When we moved in here, the property, it was just grass. It was attracting litter and people crossing through it and sometimes staying, yeah, other things, right? And right next door when we moved in, this property here, upstairs and downstairs, were, it was gangs. So they were also using this to meet, and it was just a kind of a bad scene. And that was only 5 years ago. A couple of us worked with Southside Organizing Committee to get those people evicted and to make the landlord more accountable for who he rents to. And then there's a neighborhood association here, Layton Boulevard West Neighbors, and I elected myself block captain because I am one of those people who likes to – I like a community around me. It creates, you know, harmony when people talk to each other. So I started going around and introducing myself, trying to connect neighbors to each other. Sometimes neighbors who had lived across the street for years and never said hi to each other. So then my partner had mentioned one day on the porch, we were drinking beers with our new neighbors, you know, hey, maybe we should turn that thing into a park. You know, I became the leader of the project, and we went through all these planning meetings, did surveys with the neighbors, how do they want the design, all of this kind of stuff. And over 2 years, with working and different neighbors participating and lots of meetings, lo and behold, we have this park.
Even in its infancy, this is no run-of-the-mill urban vegetable patch. Madison Garden stretches along a meandering path interspersed by benches and raised flower beds. At the back, a sculpture crafted by neighborhood kids and members of the group Artists Working in Education features reclaimed wood and plenty of colorful paint. It accents five raised vegetable patches that radiate from the six-foot-high creation. Lipschutz says one of the best parts was getting kids involved.
Now I can say to the kids, you really want to destroy what you worked so hard that one hot day to, you know? So it's been really nice.
Lipschutz may be a born neighborhood organizer and a proficient educator in French, but he's learning vegetable gardening side by side with his neighbors.
I actually am a forager. Like, I'm really into wild foods, but it's pretty nice having it right here.
The first growing season, tomatoes, peppers, everything, were planted and shared communally.
This was the first year, so we actually just planted things in boxes, and people are allowed to just come and take, which is really nice.
But will they repeat the model when spring finally does burst back on the Milwaukee landscape?
Probably not, because I think that sometimes that encourages people to come and get stuff without actually putting in any help, which the point is to meet in the garden and chat. I mean, if you listen to Venus Williams talking about Alice's Garden, that's sort of what we want here. And we have Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and Dominicans and white people and Asian, I mean, just, you know, and so encouraging interaction is one of the things we want to do.
Lipschutz and his neighbors also hope to cultivate continuity and endurance. They are collaborating with an urban land trust, Milwaukee Urban Gardens, to move from a 1 to a 3-year lease. One day, they hope to permanently secure their meandering piece of peace as a purchased parcel. As for Brett Lipschutz, he seems to be in permanent share-the-bounty mode.
If there are some ripe tomatoes, feel free to take them because I think we're done.
For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Maybe you can find a couple strawberries. It's ever-bearing strawberries, so feel free to look around.
Brett Lipschutz is one of the neighborhood leaders of the 32nd and Madison Pocket Park. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz as last summer's growing season was wrapping up. There's more information on the garden and hydrant permit event held tomorrow at WUWM.com. That's another week's worth of Lake Effect, produced by the talented team of Stephanie Lecce, Dan Harmon, and Bonnie North, with the assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Craig Wirrell, and additional web support from Michelle Maternowski. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Have a great weekend, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air is next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.